abandon free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
There will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody, on this Friday, October 18th, 2013. Tom Woods here, joined by Bob Murphy today. Bob, of course, is the author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. He's the author of Lessons for the Young Economist, which is a textbook on economics. He's written study guides for the major Austrian treatises like Mises' Human Action, Mises' Theory of Money and Credit, and Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. He has a blog at Consulting by RPM. RPM are his initials, so consultingbyrpm.com, and click on his blog, and you'll want to follow Bob regularly. Bob is our question answerer here, so I've got saved up a bunch of questions for him. I should also mention two other things about Bob. He has a PhD in economics from New York University, and also he is the zombie in the famous zombie video. If you guys are listening to the Tom Woods Show and you have not seen the zombie video, you should be ashamed of yourselves. Turn it off this minute. Or actually, no, listen to the show. Remind yourself, when the show's over, go to interviewwithazombie.com, and you'll say, how did I get by without having seen this video? And if you have seen the video, head over to interviewwithazombie.com anyway, because the blooper tape is even funnier than the actual video itself. So having said all that, I'd like to bring Bob onto the program now. Bob Murphy, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
All right, Bob, so another year, another Nobel Prize announcement, and once again, Murphy is snubbed. Can you try and make sense of the Nobel Prize winners for us, and is there any... You were speculating that there was a bit of a, if not a contradiction, then something kind of funny about Fama and Schiller both getting it, but maybe it's not so much. Maybe is it like a Myrdal and Hayek situation? Who are these people, and is there any reason we should be pleased with this?
Well, it's a great question, and I think they're snubbing me just because I'm kind of young. You know, they wouldn't want the older guys to feel bad. The upstart kid gets it.
That was how I took it.
Yeah. So I give them that. You know, I just hope I don't get hit by a bus before my work is appreciated. So as far as the Nobel, what's funny here is this is another area where the Austrians seem to have a broader historical context, because I'm pretty sure, like, the way Paul Krugman handled this was to make a joke about, yeah, in economics, it seems like the Nobel Prize goes to people who not only have different theories, but in the same year get for the same award, you know, get that when they're contradicting each other. And of course, that's what Austrians have been saying since 74, as you were alluding to. As far as this year's award, you know, it's funny. There's a lot of free market people who are saying, yep, they got it right this time. I love Fama. I've been waiting years for Fama to get it.
Oh.
And of course, you know, guys like you and I are biased because we like the Austrians and Fama's prototypical Chicago school in this respect. As far as what's the apparent contradiction, just for your listeners who don't really know, so Eugene Fama is considered arguably the father of what's called the efficient markets hypothesis. In loosely speaking, that means that at any moment, asset prices reflect all publicly available information. You can't beat the market. It's silly to put your money with a fund manager who's picking stocks based on some mechanism that he uses, or someone who follows technical analysis and looks at the charts and says, oh, it's a head and shoulders. That means the market's going to go down tomorrow, so I'm going to sell and get out in time. So all that kind of stuff that the wizards think that they can do, and that's why you should give your money to them and pay them huge management fees. The claim is that Fama kind of blew that all up by saying, no, the market's efficient. This is also related. People have heard that there's a random walk in terms of stock prices. So this is where all that comes from. Fama's not the first guy in human history to remark on this stuff, but he really is. If you had to pick somebody who's the founder of this idea, it would be him. And so then Schiller, who also shared the prize, and then also Lars Hansen did. Hansen got it more for his econometric work on, you know, studying asset prices and things like that. And I'm not really totally familiar with his work. I can't really comment much on it. But Schiller, you know, his work, again, for the layman, you know, can take it away saying that there's Schiller was documenting ways in which the market in general and financial markets in particular are not completely efficient or rational in the sense that neoclassical economists use those terms. And, you know, so it was, so this is the sense in which it's odd that on one hand, it's almost as if the Nobel Committee is saying, and again, it's not really the Nobel Prize, but it's that the, you know, Fama is being awarded for his work in showing how the stock market is efficient. You can't beat the market and so on. Don't even try. And then Schiller's being awarded in the same year, sharing the same prize for his work and showing that all the ways in which Fama is wrong. And so that's the irony. And people can hash that out as to whether that's a fair statement or not. Some people have made the analogy that, well, suppose Isaac Newton and Albert Einstein happened to be alive at the same time. Would it be so crazy for them both to win the Nobel Prize in physics for their work in understanding the behavior of matter and energy, when there's a sense in which Einstein overturned Newton? So that's the analogy some people are making, and we can speculate on that. But as far as is it a good thing, all I will say is this. Clearly, the efficient markets hypothesis, that strain of thought, has been used by a lot of economists when discussing the housing boom years and so on to even come close to denying that there was a housing bubble. So not merely saying, well, how could anyone have known that in real time? But some guys, including Fama himself, and at Mises.org, I have an article if people want to look up called Bursting Fama's Bubble that came out a few years ago, where he was saying that, I don't even know what you mean by the word bubble, because to have operational meaning, people would have to know it in real time. And if you knew that there was a stock market bubble in progress or a housing bubble, you would short the market and that would end the bubble. You know, so they're using these kind of like quick, glib arguments by which to prove that bubbles are basically impossible, at least in and for any practical sense. And that's just silly, as anyone familiar with the Austrian school would recognize.
And that's why I think it's not a good thing for Fama to get this, because I think the efficient markets hypothesis makes it sound, it comes off as almost like a caricature of free market belief, that the market is so efficient in his kind of way of speaking that you can't possibly have a bubble, because we all would have thought of that. That's so misguided as to be frustrating. But can you just elaborate on one small subtlety in your remark? You said it's not really the Nobel Prize. Not everybody knows what you mean by that.
You're right, Tom. The reason I even said that is because whenever I refer matter-of-factly to the Nobel Prize in economics with no quotation marks or any caveats like that, you'll get people in the comments who jump all over you and say, no, Alfred Nobel did not set up the prize in economic sciences. That was instituted later by the Swedish Central Bank, and it's the Nobel Memorial Award in Economic Sciences or something like that. So it's actually they bring it out at the same time when the other genuine Nobel awards are given, but actually the economists who win it are not receiving something that was endowed by Alfred Nobel.
That's interesting, right.
In and of itself, because it's, you know, as Austrians have said, that it's the mainstream economists, they have this pining, they want to be like the physicists, they want to be real scientists, and so this is kind of another example of that.
All right, I have a question that I want clarified, because I think a lot of people are confused about it. So I'm going to ask it on behalf of the general public. And that is a question that is answered in a basic economics course you would take in college. But it deals with the subject of a strong dollar and a weak dollar and exports. And we hear it said, well, you don't want to have a strong dollar. You want to have a weak dollar. And you want a situation in which exports from your country are favored. And that comes about by manipulating the money and all that. Can you sort out exactly what that's all about and how it can be that in the long run, or can it be that in the long run you can in fact boost your exports by manipulating your currency, or is this only some kind of short-run effect? And if so, give us an example of how that works.
Okay, that's a great question. So the very short-term, narrow perspective where these people are coming from is they're saying, look, foreigners, when they're trying to decide whether they want to buy things domestically in their own currency or they want to from their point of view, import it from the United States. So from our point of view, it's exports. They got to look at the prices. And of course, they can't just look at the price that's on the sticker in their country and our country because they're using a different currency. So if people in France, let's say, are thinking about buying wine there, they'll see how many euros it is. And then they'll look at a similar bottle of wine that's available in the United States, and they'll be quoted in dollars. And so for them to be able to compare the two to say which is cheaper, obviously they need to know what's the dollar-euro exchange rate. And so that's the sense in which if you held everything else equal, and then all of a sudden the dollar weakened against the euro, well, then the people who hold euros now can buy more with their euros and goods that are priced in dollars. And so other things equal, if the dollar weakened, well, then they would be able to buy wine from the United States more cheaply than wine from France. And so you would see more exports of wine to France. The problem with that, though, is why did the dollar weaken? And so if the dollar weakened because Bernanke just announced, oh, we're going to increase the rate of creation of U.S. dollars, well, other things aren't going to remain equal. That's going to push up the dollar price of goods in the United States. And so there's going to be a wash in the long run. You know, just as a simple crude thought experiment, if they doubled the quantity of dollars, roughly speaking, and say, okay, the dollar-euro exchange rate would get cut in half. And so, yeah, people holding euros can now buy twice as much stuff, but then everything in the United States quoted in dollar bills is now twice as expensive when you're looking at the sticker, right? So I'm simplifying there, but I'm just trying to get you to see the insight that depreciating your currency is not a method of promoting exports in the long run. You know, if you think about it, there's a sense in which in the long run, a country pays for its imports with its exports and vice versa. And so it's not that you're going to fool foreigners into buying more of your stuff than they really wanted to in the long run. Certainly not by debasing your currency. That's not the path to prosperity.
So in other words, eventually the market sort of figures out, wait a minute. No fundamentals have changed. It's just one country manipulated its money, and then prices will wind up adjusting so that there will be no benefit that you could get from being in one one currency as opposed to another. Am I right?
Right. I think that's the way to deal with the primitive, naive argument that, oh, all we need to do is weaken the dollar and that's how we're going to promote exports. So there are complications that come in that, strictly speaking, it's not just goods in the sense of finished products for consumers to use. There's also financial assets. And so if people around the world wanted to invest in U.S. assets, then we could afford to have a trade deficit, which would not weaken our currency. And so there's various complications like that. But yeah, the way you just summarized it, I think that's the first thing you got to realize when somebody says just very naively, oh, we don't want to have the dollar be too strong because then we won't be able to export anything. You have to ask yourself, well, why is the dollar so strong? And certainly in the long run, if the U.S., for example, were on a genuine commodity money, it's true that, oh, gee, that the currency, if you quoted it in terms of that commodity money, would presumably appreciate year after year against all the fiat currencies of the world. But that wouldn't spell disaster. Once people got used to that new equilibrium, the prices of goods in the United States quoted in that commodity money would probably gently fall over time, what some people refer to as good deflation. And so, again, that there would be a wash there that, yeah, the other people holding fiat currencies, whatever we were quoting it in, it would get weaker and weaker. But then the same token, the sticker prices here would gently fall to counteract that.
Well, let's talk for a minute about China, because we always hear about China's manipulating its currency to benefit its export sector. Now, is it doing so, number one? But secondly, my question would be, given what we've just said, that at least in the naive version, you can see how eventually there'll be an adjustment and there won't be any long-run benefit to doing this. In order to have a strategy like this, wouldn't you have to be constantly debasing your currency? Debasing it. And then at that point, eventually the market's going to anticipate a further debasement and again adjust prices ahead of it. So that wouldn't any alleged benefit coming from this sort of strategy exhaust itself?
That's a great question, and I'm glad I sort of hedged myself there and said it gets a little bit more complicated when you bring in financial assets. So yeah, with China, there's two things going on. Is they're creating money, yuan, and then they're using that to go into the currency markets to trade their currencies against dollars and then use the dollars to buy U.S. treasuries, which are bonds issued by the U.S. federal government. And so that's what's going on there. That in the, if you think about it from one perspective, in terms of the international trade flows and accounting, in a sense, the reason the United States is able to consistently buy more goods from China than China buys from the United States is that China is also mopping up more of our financial assets than vice versa. And so that's where the gap is filled. So the trade of balance of trades or the balance of payments always does balance when you include financial assets. So back to your question, is China deliberately weakening its own currency? Because if you think about it, why would that weaken their currency? Because they're having, for them to do that, for them to consistently buy more financial assets from the U.S. than vice versa, that means they have to go into the currency markets with their currency and buy dollars with it. So that makes the dollar stronger against their currency than it would be if they stopped doing that. And so it's funny, people simultaneously are worried that China might try to threaten us by not buying more of our debt. You know, they have us over a barrel if they ever threatened in an international standoff to say to the U.S., you know what, we're going to stop financing your federal government's deficit if you don't play ball with us in terms of foreign policy. So on the one hand, people are mad at China at that. And on the other hand, the same people often complain that China is deliberately weakening its currency in order to promote its exports. But those are the two sides of the same coin. The way they are allegedly weakening their currency by not letting their currency strengthen against the dollar is that they go into the currency markets in order to buy U.S. dollars so they can keep sopping up our government's debt. So I don't know exactly what's in their heads. I think part of it is they saw what happened in the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s, and they said, you know what, we don't want to be vulnerable about that, or we don't want to be vulnerable in that kind of a situation, and so we want to have an ability to assure investors around the world that our currency is as strong as the dollar. So we want to build up dollar reserves so that if for some reason there ever were a run on Asian currencies, people would trust us because we got all these dollar reserves and we can support the strength of our currency. So it's, again, I don't know exactly what's in their head. I think at this point, they're almost wishing they could get out of the dollar because they see what Bernanke's been doing, but they don't want to cause a panic. So whatever the actual situation is, for sure, the Chinese government cannot continue to sop up U.S. government debt without at the same time providing the mechanism by which the United States can continue to run a trade deficit with them, which only works because they are holding the U.S. dollar artificially strong against their own currency. So those things all are interrelated, and it's just odd that a lot of neocons and other people simultaneously complain about two things that have to go together.
What about from the point of view of the average American consumer? Is there a sense in which the average American consumer is benefited or harmed by the Chinese manipulation of its currency?
Well, for sure, I would say everybody on planet Earth is ultimately harmed when a particular government creates money and makes it easier for the United States government to run deficits and so on. So that's what's happening. So I think certainly the Chinese government and its associated monetary institutions and central bank, I think they're setting their people up for an Austrian boom-bust cycle in what they've been doing. And then it's particularly egregious in that the way they're going to finance what they're doing with that new money is to lower interest rates for the United States government, make it easier for the United States government to spend more money than they take in taxes. So that's certainly not good for the average earthling, I would think. As far as the direct issue of the impact to American consumers, I think there the analysis is comparable to if, let's say, there's some foreign government that for whatever reason taxes its own people in order to subsidize exports from its own country. And so effectively they're lowering the price to U.S. consumers by making their own people defray some of the costs of the goods they're sending the U.S. consumers. So in that narrow respect, it's good. American consumers are helped if some foreign government stupidly wants to tax its own people in order to give us stuff at a better price. You know, in the limit, if some foreign government wanted to make it completely free and just completely subsidize their exports so that they were sending us stuff across the ocean for nothing and we were getting free TVs, obviously that makes us better off. Yeah, our industry would adjust to that new situation, but there's a prima facie sense in which if we're getting stuff for free, that's obviously making us wealthier.
Now, finally, on this subject, I really just want to exhaust this subject. Why are exports so important? Why is there this fixation with stimulating exports through monetary manipulation? Why are exports the key to prosperity? Is it simply the export sector happens to be politically powerful? Why exports?
Well, there's two ways of answering that. One is in terms of the economists and the analysts who are pushing it on paper, what's the rationale they're giving. And then the other angle is in the real world, politically, what's going on. So I think you're right that politically, in terms of public choice economics, the way you would answer is to say that it's the classic thing. Why are there tariffs? Why are there any kind of favors given to exporters? It's because of the or to people who are producing domestically and you want to keep out cheap foreign imports. And the answer there, which I think is basically correct, is just the issue of concentrated benefits and dispersed costs. So politically, it's easy for the government to favor exporters at the expense of importers or just the general public, because the exporters clearly benefit. They can contribute to the campaigns and so on, and they know what's going on. Whereas the average person, it's hard for him to understand exactly why everything he buys is a little bit more expensive. As far as the economics, like if you ask somebody who's a genuine proponent of this, why, like somebody like Paul Krugman or something, I think it just goes back to the Keynesian mindset that they're all about what do you do when the economy's in the slumps, in the doldrums, you want to stimulate spending. And so if you think about it, net exports in terms of the standard equation that you'll probably learn in introductory macroeconomics if you took that in college, is Y equals C plus I plus G plus net exports. GDP is the sum of all the spending in the economy. That's the way Keynesians look at it. And so if you saw that equation in your textbooks, Y equals C plus I plus G plus net exports. And so that's why Keynesians, or analysis of a newspaper article writer who's talking about the economy, will say, consumer spending is down. Business investment is down. Businessmen are very afraid of the future here. What are we going to do? We need the government to come in and run a big deficit. Well, by the same token, the fourth element in that is foreigners on net buying more of our stuff than we buy of theirs. That's what net exports are. And so in terms of all the different spending streams that add up to GDP, the total spending in the economy, foreigners buying our stuff is one element of it. So I think that's partly why today's economists with their Keynesian mindset often come back to that and stress exports. I don't think there's any real reason in the grand scheme that if you understand why you don't need to encourage consumers to go consume more, the way you fix the economy is to get people to go to the mall and blow their paycheck. If you can see what's wrong with that mentality, then by the same token, you can see why there's no reason the government ought to be encouraging the export sector to the detriment of every other sector.
All right, let me ask you just a yes or no question here. Is this why some people have said that there's a link between Keynesianism and mercantilism, and why Keynes even said that the mercantilists have been unjustly maligned and they actually had some decent ideas? Are you able to give an unnuanced yes or no answer to that?
Yes.
Good. That's All right, let me switch gears entirely. Robots. I want to ask you about robots. And what I mean is, we all know that the invention of the train was a net benefit for society, because now the market is much wider. You can have a much broader array of goods because they can be transported to all different marketplaces now, and you have a bigger potential set of consumers who can consume them, and you can be infinitely more efficient and all these other things. All the people who instead used to carry freight on horseback or whatever, all those people are now freed up to produce other things. We couldn't have had those other things before because these people were stuck carrying stuff on their backs instead of working on producing widgets and all the things they can produce now. So we see that technological advances and labor-saving devices, these do not destroy jobs. They create new ones. These are great. But the scenario that you sometimes see that people propose just for the sake of argument is, suppose one day we get to a point where robots can basically do everything, and then nobody has any jobs. This seems to be the ultimate direction where capitalism is heading, and yet in that scenario, yeah, okay, somebody's got to repair or create the robots, but you could build robots to do that. So, in other words, is there a robot endgame where it actually turns out that technological advance is a net minus because it takes so many jobs away from us? Where is the fallacy in that?
Well, one way of seeing it is to say, forget that question for a moment. Let's just pretend we started new and we're sitting around just talking to our friends saying, imagine just a complete, almost utopia, like people who are into science fiction and whatnot. Just imagine a world that's just wonderful and it's gorgeous and it's just almost heaven on earth. What would that look like? And they would probably start describing and say, well, everyone just lounges around reading philosophy all day and watching movies and hanging out with their friends. And then machines and robots do all the work. That's what paradise would be. And, you know, nobody ever has to toil or you have to work 1 hour per year. And all the material benefits of our infrastructure and these robots just cranking things out. And we go and explore the stars and so on. We have ships that are taking us around and we're just explorers. And we don't really work. It's just all about what we're doing with our leisure. But our leisure is not merely lounging around. It's doing all sorts of really exciting things and exploring the universe. I think that's what a lot of people, particularly those who are attracted to science fiction, would describe as a future universe that was wonderful and too bad we can't live there. And so that's one way of explaining. So then why would you be afraid of robots becoming so productive that there's less and less for people to do? That's the one way of looking at it. Now, it's true, you can come up with scenarios in which, oh, well, wouldn't some person who doesn't own any robots, wouldn't that person be at a disadvantage because now he can't even sell his labor since the robots can do everything he can do? Conceivably, that could happen, but also if the world is that fantastically wealthy, where the people who were lucky enough to have gotten in on the investments and they own the robots and that's why they're the ones in charge of everything, I mean, they could certainly donate to charity and is a worst case scenario. So I don't think there's any sense in which if you're worried about the fate of humanity, that making us much more productive and expanding our ability to give charity to people who for whatever reason get left behind as the economy progresses, I can't see how that's going to be a problem, or that if you had to choose, you would rather stymie that technological innovation.
It's just hard, I think, to see where people's purchasing power comes from in a case like that. I mean, it could be that the robots mean that we can produce an awful lot of stuff, but where do I get the wherewithal to buy the stuff from?
Well, let me just take it to the extreme. In the extreme, which is the alleged nightmare scenario, where no human labor, where you earn like basically one penny per hour because the robots are so efficient, that's the only way to make it worthwhile for an employer to hire you. Otherwise, they'll hire the robots. Just think that through.
Yep.
Somebody owns the robots, first of all, right? They're generating all this output. Somebody is the owner of that. So clearly some humans are benefiting. And then one way of seeing it is, okay, land factors would clearly be very useful and valuable in that setting, in capital goods. And so maybe you just own 1 acre of land that's fairly productive. And that was handed down to you from your great grandfather at a time back when labor was actually human labor was remunerative. And that's what you own. And you get so much just from that. So, you know, the people, the entrepreneurs who come in, who hire robots to come in and till the soil and so on, they don't need you to go pick crops because that's useless. That's crazy. Nobody would use human beings anymore to pick crops. That's obsolete. But you own just that 1 acre. And from today's standards, owning 1 acre is not a very big deal. But at that future time, the machines are so productive that that 1 acre of land actually gives you more consumption than right now Bill Gates can afford.
Bob, take 30 seconds to tell people about the economics course that you started yesterday and how they can join in.
Sure. So yesterday I began the first of a six-week course called Basics of Economics. It's at the Mises Academy. You go to academy.mises.org to sign up for it. And we're going through the first section of my textbook, Lessons for the Young Economist. And it's just a very general introduction to free market economics from an Austrian perspective. So it's great for homeschoolers, but also even for adults. If you never liked economics in college, never really thought you understood how the economy works, in this course, we take it from step one. We don't assume any prior knowledge, and I think you'll really enjoy it.
Thanks, Bob. We'll have you back soon. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Tom.
And that does it for another week of The Tom Woods Show. My thanks to Bob Murphy. Make sure and check him out at consultingbyrpm.com. Tomorrow, October 19th, 2013, I will be in Raleigh, North Carolina. I hope you will be there too. And of course, do me a favor and check out my labor of love, libertyclassroom.com. It's never too late to get the education they should have given you but didn't. You can learn from me and from other people you can trust over at libertyclassroom.com. All right, that's it, everybody. See you next week. Thanks for listening.
The Tom Woods Show.